Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Matt Scalisi, editor of FilmNerds.com. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films.
Hey, Matt, how are you doing?
I am good, Ben.
Well, we both saw Guardians of the Galaxy, and there are a number of things to talk about, but we thought we would kind of try to format our conversation around something, kind of a greater topic in movies, especially for this film. And so right off the bat, we should say that this is going to be somewhat a conversation about spoilers, and therefore we'll have spoilers in it for both Guardians
about,
of the Galaxy movies.
Only about this movie.
Yeah, well, this and the first one, obviously.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not going to just throw out spoilers for Titanic, you know, in the middle of the conversation.
Right.
Yeah, so first of all, I guess the question off the top of the head is, did marketing, did spoilers, these are topics that have been in, you know, in the conversation of film people for a while now, but very recently here on Film Nerds, Ben Flanagan and I had a conversation about what constitutes a spoiler, and you know what is a spoiler, and why do they bug us, and things like that. So it's kind of top of mind right now. And this is a movie that was heavily marketed, and elements of it were kind of shared in trailers to the point that that the director actually had to put out a statement about, you know, how, well, this isn't a spoiler, and it's not going to ruin the movie, and if it ruins the movie for you, then we didn't do our job, and yada, 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 all this other stuff. So it's kind of wrapped up in it. So the primary question, I guess, is, was this movie spoiled for us by its marketing? And I guess just to ruin everything off the bat, I'm going to go ahead and say, no, I love this movie, and it was fantastic. There were a few things that, you know, I wish I hadn't seen going in, but there's a separate question of, do spoilers ruin a movie, or do they spoil a movie, and what that means. But no, for me, I had a great time with Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. So I guess right off the bat, let's just go into that a little bit. What did you think of this movie?
Yeah, I had a great time. I have already been referred to today by one of our fellow film nerds as Marvel Boy, which I'm fine with. That's actually, that's a decent comic, which I have read before. So
I was going to say, it wasn't in any of the post-credits sequences.
No, Marvel Boy did not appear in this movie. Yeah. He's one of the only characters that did. But there, I really liked it a lot. I think that this movie, hard as it might be for me to sell anybody on this movie kind of had a high bar for me to clear compared to a lot of other Marvel movies, because I love Guardians of the Galaxy, and I would say it was pretty firmly my number one Marvel movie coming into this sequel, and I really wanted this to live up to that. You know, I don't think I expected to feel the same way about this movie as I did the first, but I wanted it to build off of what I liked about the first movie, and I wanted it to keep giving me the feeling that the first one did. And it did, and it did so from directions I wasn't expecting. Because to me, the thing that puts Guardians of the Galaxy so firmly above the rest of the Marvel movies for me is that it has this emotional angle to it. And I think they develop the main character so much more effectively in Guardians of the Galaxy than most Marvel movies do. They give us a real emotional moment that is so much more powerful and hard-hitting without betraying the very lighthearted tone of the movie. And, you know, you get into this movie, and I would say you get about, you know, four-fifths of the way through it or so, and I'm enjoying it a lot. I liked it. I had a great time. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, this is really good, but it's not going to pack the same punch as the first one, because they're not going to really be able to hit that same emotional territory. And then they pull a trick on you where you suddenly have a relationship that was there all along in the first movie, but they do something narratively that adds depth to what happened in the first movie and gives us an incredible emotional moment to close this movie out on. And I just think it was such a brilliant turn, not only how they executed, but the fact that they did it basically at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy 2, they make us wait for the emotional moment instead of starting the movie the way that the first movie does with that emotional moment. I think it was really cool. It was clever. I didn't see it coming. And, you know, to me, if there's anything that could be spoiled in this movie, it was the idea that Yondu turns out to be kind of such a key figure in the story, and that the biggest emotional moment is built around Yondu. To me, that was not spoiled. I didn't read anything or see anything to indicate that was coming. And, you know, the movie really didn't. And look, I get caught up in trying to judge a movie while I'm watching it, and I think probably we're all a little guilty of that, especially when we have high anticipation for a movie. And this one, you gotta just sit there and experience it and let it all play out, because I felt very differently walking out of the theater than I did about halfway through this movie.
Yeah, that's what you just said. Kind of that's where the spoiler thing comes in for me, is that what spoilers and early reviews hurt for me is that experience. You know, it's like because I know of what the studio wants me to think and what other reviewers and critics think, I'm fighting those perceptions in my head as I'm watching the movie, and then fighting my own, you know, expectations and things like that. And it's too much mental activity for me to bear. I'm very stupid. So it's, yeah, I had a similar fight with this. And what, yes, the Yondu thing was far from even being close to spoiled for me. But what did kind of came close to being spoiled was the Ego, Kurt Russell, being Quill's biological father, and Kurt Russell being the planet Ego, which, you know, those were both out there, from what I understand. Like, that information was out there.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and that, I would say that if you were a subscriber to Entertainment Weekly or some such similar publication, you have known about that for months. I mean, it may be in the trailer, but...
Yeah, I don't think they ever say Ego in the trailer, but they definitely said, you know, Kurt Russell comes out and says, hey, I'm your dad. Which,
he's his dad.
Well, yeah, and that's frustrating.
There's an approach that, I get it, and I think in an ideal, perfect world, we would, at this point, I would be fine never knowing anything about any Marvel movie before it comes out. Not seeing a single promotional still, nothing. Just tell me this is the next MCU movie, and I'm there as soon as I can be there. But I also recognize that that's not realistic, and it's not possible. So I have to deal with a realistic approach to being a fan. I'm enough of a fan of these things that I am going to want to read a little bit about them, but I also, at this point, trust the people behind this franchise enough to know that I don't want to read too much about it. So,
right.
Because they've been pretty aggressive at this point. I would say the way that they are approaching these movies, as far as that goes, is anything in the first act of these movies seems to be considered completely fair game to be marketed openly. And I think that sucks a little bit, but I also understand why they have to do that. They want, these are very high concept movies that not everybody who's going to see them knows the entire premise and the setup. And so they feel like they should be able to basically tell you, okay, about 30 minutes into this movie, here's where you will find yourself. I don't love that, but I can accept it and I can deal with it. And I think, to me, you asked the question earlier of is having a movie spoiled different than having it ruined? And I think it definitely is the case. To me, if I had known that Yondu had a big reveal and that the the big emotional peak of the movie involved Yondu, that would have ruined the movie for me, or at least my viewing experience of it.
Right.
But knowing that the main antagonist of the movie was Ego and that it was Peter Quill's dad, that maybe spoiled a cool element of the movie, but it didn't ruin my viewing experience at all.
Yeah, that's kind of where I come down. And it's, for me, I don't want my moment spoiled. And that was, it's just that coming out of Guardians 1, one of the primary questions about this character was, who is his dad? And to give away such a, and obviously that is the central question here, and James Gunn throws his curveball and says, well, you're asking the wrong question. You know, it's more important not to ask who his biological father is, but who his daddy is, as Yondu puts it in the movie. And that's interesting, and that's great for James Gunn to intelligently play with expectations like that. But still, like, I don't even want the red herring, spoiled for me, because that's a moment in the movie that I would love to process. And obviously, this is something that, you know, within the first seconds of Guardians Volume 2 starting, you see Kurt Russell with Peter Quill's mom, and so you can put together that next time you see him that this is going to be his father. So it's like the trailer really just spoiled the first 3 seconds of the movie. So, I mean, there's so many counter-arguments, but still, it's just kind of, and again, my answer is no, it didn't spoil the movie. It didn't even really spoil that moment, but it's still like, guys, just, why'd you have to do that? Like, I still don't get, like, why they have to do that. And then, before the movie, slight tangent, there was a trailer for Spider-Man Homecoming, and that seems to make my case all over again, because it just feels like the first and possibly second act of that movie are just, like, laid out, like, in
there's
the trailer.
There's a lot of stuff in that trailer. And,
yeah,
again, like I said, it's like they want to go, like, it's like if you don't, maybe if you don't trust them, a teaser seems to be cut almost perfect by Marvel these days.
Right.
They show you some insanely cool stuff, and then you're out. But,
yep.
But when you get the full trailers, especially usually the last full trailer, it really is like, and maybe this goes way beyond Marvel, maybe this is just something I'm only noticing now, but it is like they want to reassure a potential viewer that once you've been in this movie for about an hour or so, here's exactly what you will have learned by then. Just so
yeah,
you know. Just so,
yeah,
just so you're not taken by surprise. Here's what,
yeah,
here's where you're going to be. And then
here's what you're paying
there,
for.
It'll all be surprised after that. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think that's a little bit dumbing down your own audience that you're asking to come to the movie. It's like you're setting them,
yep,
up to be a little bit dumbed down in terms of their experience.
Yep.
And, I would obviously be thrilled at this point if they are all more like teasers. The Thor Ragnarok trailer, by contrast, is exactly
perfect
what I want from a trailer right now. Pretty much just out of context images. I get the basic idea of what's going to happen in this movie, but really no sense of the direction of the plot or the sequence of things. I know that there's, look, I guess some people would have considered that a reveal, but this is now being openly marketed as this is a Thor and Hulk movie. So fine,
yeah,
like there's a great reveal of Hulk in the trailer. I kind of almost view that as like a press release of like, hey, Hulk's in this movie. And now I'm kind of good. You know, I'm as excited as I could possibly be for that movie. And I don't need to see anything else. But I understand that that's not how Disney feels comfortable marketing a movie. They need to reassure people more that they're not going to be confused and they're not going to be lost and they don't need to see all these other movies before they go see it. And I've heard a lot of people actually just anecdotally in my life either texting me to ask or asking on Facebook saying, I haven't seen Guardians of the Galaxy. Do I need, you know, can I borrow it from you? Do I need to see it before I see the second one? Like, people want to see these movies. But I think there's some hesitance that they're going to feel lost if they haven't seen,
yeah,
if not the first movie of this installment, of like all the other Marvel movies, you know? And I would love to get an opinion from somebody at some point about a total newbie to Marvel movies watching, maybe not this one, because I think it does stand alone pretty well, but like, you know, this next Thor movie or
Civil War.
Or Civil War, certainly. Like, does that register with you? Do you feel completely lost? Did you need a lot of marketing to make you feel comfortable seeing this movie?
Yeah, I remember, I think my office went to go see Avengers Age of Ultron, and several people were like, what?
Right.
Is this the one with Superman? It was just like, they were just like baffled. So yeah, I mean, I do think that, yeah, it's interesting, the whole marketing thing, it's like, the closer you are to the material, the less you want to see it, and the earlier you see it, you know? It's like, oh, I mean, I'm like obsessed with these movies, so as soon as there's a trailer, like a year out, a teaser, I will see it. I will see that teaser. It won't have very much, and then that's all I want to see. However, people that have lead normal lives and are normally adjusted and don't have psychological problems, you know, live their lives, and then like a week before or like 3 days or the day of, they realize this movie came out, and they're like, oh, and then they watch this like expansive trailer, and they're like, oh, okay, well, now I know I'm going to get what I pay for, you know, and I know what I'm getting myself into.
Hey, let me get two for Galactic Guardians.
Let me get two
that
for
guy.
Raccoons.
Let me get two for Space Raccoon in the tree. That little tree.
Let me get two for DreamWorks Raccoons. So it's like those people. Yeah, it's like they figured out, and it's all it is that I have to stop. You know, like that's the problem. Is me.
Right.
Stopping myself from watching these trailers. Or, I mean, the problem with some trailers is, like, the Spider-Man trailer, like, I had no choice. I was in the theater to see another movie, and,
yeah.
And this thing was playing out. And that's the thing. It's like, man, if they just, like, left the super expansive trailers to, like, TV, you know, or somewhere where I could turn it off or mute it or leave.
TV! Did you realize, Stark, you realize that a lot of people do watch TV, though, right?
Like, that's what I'm saying.
That nobody will see things.
No, that's exactly. Well, it is. It is a wasteland. It's worthless. But what I'm saying is that, I mean, those casual movie people are watching TV. You know, they're watching HGTV or Fox News or whatever normal people watch. And so you have the expansive trailers on there, so they're like, oh, what? I didn't know they were making another Guardians. Oh, it's out today. Let me go watch it. Great.
Yeah.
But, like, don't force me to see it if I'm one of your loyal people that's going to see one of your other movies opening day, you know? I don't know.
Sure.
It's just hard to avoid. But to come back to this movie, it was not ruined by any stretch of the imagination. It was not spoiled. Just to go way back to what you were saying earlier, I was having the same experience as you, where I was wrestling with the movie as it went on before me. Like, the movie started, and we get a digitally de-aged Kurt Russell, and my wife, like,
I knew y'all would be mad about that. I knew
you
would be upset.
Patted me on the leg. She, like, patted me on the leg, like, it'll be okay.
Yeah, good for her.
And I was like, ugh. And then right after that, there was the end. It goes back to something that Ben and I talked about in our May opener podcast about an issue with Iron Man 2, and to a much greater degree, like the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, where there's something that catches on with the culture in the first movie, and the filmmakers in the sequel kind of become marks for themselves and pat themselves on the back and just kind of like go crazy. You know, the way that Jack Sparrow is just like worshipped in the follow-up movies. Or the way that Iron Man 2 is just like wallows in the Robert Downey Jr. improv sessions. And it always never works as well, you know, because it feels like the filmmakers are, you know, so satisfied with themselves. So whenever the baby Groot dancing while an action scene happens in the background, that's the vibe I was getting there. I was like, oh man, they are so, James Gunn fell way too far in love with the memes, you know, that came out of his work on the first movie, that he's just, this is it, that this is what it's going to be. And within 10 minutes, that had worn off. And I got back into the vibe of the movie, the vibe of this, these characters, and I was great. And then, yeah, as the movie kind of emotionally evolved and we got everything until the last shot of this movie is a close-up of a crying CGI raccoon. And it's, like, it's amazing. Like, and it's totally, yeah, it totally works. And it's so sincere and in such a sarcastic and, you know, in a certain way, smug movie, sincerity is still there. You know, this isn't Deadpool or Suicide Squad, where it's just like sincerity is gross and stupid and lame, so let's avoid it. This movie, like, wallows in it, you know, and wears its heart on its sleeve. And I think that's where it always brings me back. Like, I keep remembering moments from this movie, which I think is more laugh-out-loud funny than the first one, but I keep remembering, like, really funny moments from it, and realizing that, wow, not only was that a really funny moment, but it actually was rooted in, like, some sort of character or emotion as well. And it's really, really well done. And it's, I see people dismissing this movie as, like, fine or, like, middle of the road or whatever. And it's like, okay, it's another example of us taking this for granted, because we've got this auteur filmmaker who wrote this script, you know, by himself. And directed this movie with a very eccentric and personal visual style that evolved from the first one, and we're treating it like it's another Transformers movie, you know, or a Taken movie, you know, of just this, like, product. And it's like, God, this isn't a product. This is going to make a lot of money, and this is going to sell a lot of stuffed baby Groots, but this is not just a shallow Hollywood product, you know?
Yeah, I think what's interesting about the responses I've seen to it so far is I think people are so conditioned to saying a certain thing about a sequel that fits the sort of basic profile that this movie fits that they look at certain things and it triggers this automatic response in them to say, oh, Baby Groot, so it's merchandise, and they took a thing that happened in the first movie and overdid it in this one. Oh, there's jokes in this movie. Well, that's because people thought the first movie was so funny, so they put more jokes. Well, yeah, no shit. It's funny. Like, can we not credit a movie for being funny? Like,
right.
That's a good thing. That's why we go see some movies. But I think I probably was bought in a little bit faster. Because number one, CGI Kurt Russell face didn't bother me. I think they actually kept him pretty well hidden. They didn't try to show off that he was a CGI face the way that maybe they've done with some other examples of this. So I thought they did a nice job of being discreet about it. But really, Baby Groot in the opening scene, look, I can understand somebody not liking the opening scene. I enjoyed it, and I thought it was really funny that they – and sort of subversive that they kept what otherwise would have looked like. Look, it was cool imagery, but at this point, as weird as it is to say, we've all seen people on jetpacks shooting lasers at a giant monster. So
that's great.
Make that in the background of something else ridiculous going on. And that's what this franchise is all about so far. It's subverting the genre in clever ways. So I like that scene. And then I think as the movie went on, I actually found that I think Baby Groot works as a character for me a lot better than Groot did in the first movie.
Ooh.
Groot in the first movie is your sort of generic Chewbacca stand-in. And in this movie, there's something different to him. And I don't know if I could diagram it just quite right yet, but it works as a comedic character to me better. Like, really, the ideal Baby Groot scene in this movie for me is when Yondu and Rocket are in a jail cell, and they're trying to communicate to him to bring them a specific thing, and it gets funnier every time he fails. And for me, that is a thing that I don't think would have worked as well with full-size Groot from the first movie. So I think they really used him well and kind of made him his own thing in this movie. And I really think in general, every character in the movie became kind of a more refined and a little bit better version of themselves than we saw in the first movie.
Yes.
You know, maybe if I go back and look, I would say that they might end up being more exaggerated in this movie, but I think they kind of got purified down to, we figured out what is the thing about them that makes them likable and unique, and we really emphasized it in this movie. And
yeah, I mean,
think,
I think Drax
for sure,
yes.
I think was used well in this movie. I think Rocket doesn't, you know, we actually get stuff out of Rocket that we didn't get in the first movie. Like, there's actually a scene of him beating up a bunch of people without a gun, which I think is a cool idea, too, and kind of plays against what we expect out of that character. And, you know, I think the fact that we got such great character moments out of every character in the movie and all this other stuff that we haven't even talked about yet, all of this completely new stuff that really didn't have anything to do with the first movie, and they fit it all in, it really reminds me a lot of the job that Joss Whedon did in Age of Ultron, and that I guess the Russos sort of did in Civil War, but this is just feels different to me. I don't know. I think in a way all the characters get served even better in this movie than those other two I mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think Gamora is about the only one that doesn't have as much to do, but because more of her story is about Nebula, you know? But
yeah,
she does
sure.
undergo a change, and, I mean, their relationship is really strong, you know? Like, I could have had way more of that. But yeah, they kind of backed off. I mean, this is much less of a Star-Lord movie than the first movie was, and I like that. You know, I feel like everybody got a lot more time to develop, and yeah, I mean, Rocket is, I mean, he's got to be like one of my five favorite MCU characters at this point. He's just so well realized, and we keep learning more about him and keep going deeper with him, and it's so good.
Nebula made a big push in this movie, I have to say.
Yeah, she's good.
The scene where I can't remember the character's name, but it's James Gunn's brother, the sort of
right,
main Ravager. Is kind of just walking casually through a hallway with her.
Yeah.
And he's like, so what are you going to do now with all this money? And she goes on this absolutely maniacal rant where we're just slow zooming in on her face as she's talking about how she's going to rip Thanos apart. Like, that was both a comedic moment, but also I kind of got, like, legit chills of, like, oh, shit, I want to see Nebula. Like,
yeah.
I want to see her get blood from Thanos, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I want her to be in Infinity War.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's you mentioned the Avengers thing, and I think, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a good example of this, but just in general, in the Avengers movies and in Civil War, you have these moments where, like, two characters interact. I guess the best way to put it is the first time that Mark Ruffalo and Robert Downey Jr. talk in the Avengers, and you're like, wow, like, these are two characters that have a lot of weight and a lot of gravity and have a lot of backstory that we're really, you know, familiar with. And I never even imagined what it would be like when they got in the same room. And they connect on so many different levels that I never would have expected. And by the end of that movie, they feel like such good friends. It's like, wow, that's something I just didn't expect. I think you get that with a good writer who, you know, just knows how to bounce two characters off of each other. And you get that here where there's this connection between Rocket and Yondu that's like, you watch the first movie and you would never imagine that those two characters would bond, you know? And it's like, this is what happens when you have a bunch of great characters and then a writer who knows how to weave them in with each other, you know, and not just send them off on their own little individual missions.
Yeah, you get the sense that in the writing process for this movie, just like it has been for the best of the Marvel movies, involves someone actually asking the question, what would this guy do in this situation?
Yeah.
How would these two play off of each other? You know, and that's a question that that's what makes these movies actually compelling, and that's why I want to keep going back and watching them, and that's why I don't care when people, when the criticisms come of Marvel movies and people say, well, the villains aren't very good, the action sequences are all kind of derivative of each other. Like, that's why I don't care about that stuff, because these movies are ultimately just a, even if this is all they were, was just a collection of scenes of a bunch of characters that I like interacting with each other and playing off of each other. That's why I like these movies, because I like these characters, and I think they're very fun versions of characters that have been written about so many times by so many dozens of writers that we can probably figure out what the most interesting version of them is. And these people making these movies so far have done a good job of that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you mentioned before, there's so much here to get into. I just kind of feel like watching it again, especially now that I've gotten past my hang-ups with the opening. I kind of want to go through it again and just kind of enjoy it without the neuroses of has it been spoiled for me, or am I not liking this, without that being there. But yeah, just overall, I mean, you mentioned the character stuff is so great. Yeah, that's great, but I think also that this is one of the more visually accomplished movies in the Marvel universe. There's so much going on in every frame, and James Gunn uses like the foreground, the background really well. I saw Super in like 2011. And I thought it was fine, and I was not like blown away by it, and I never would have guessed that he would have grown into the accomplished visual filmmaker that he has become.
It's a really strange upset, and this is forever like the fact that I love these two movies as much as I do is the ultimate kind of glaring example of how wrong I can be. Like the ultimate example of how badly I can guess whether I'm going to like something or not. Because I was incredibly skeptical based on what little of his work I'd seen coming into these and just on the concept because I didn't know anything about it coming in. And, I think this is the guy that clearly gets these characters for sure. But obviously is just a really great writer, and I have to try to give more of his stuff a chance going forward outside of the Guardian stuff. I think what he got to do in this movie, especially, and what kind of showed his comic nerd credentials, is how many disparate elements of the Marvel cosmic universe that he pulls into this movie and uses for more than just like neat little throwaway cameos. There are plenty of those, but
oh yeah,
I think the fact that there's this subplot going on that does give some more weight to Yondu's story of this group of other Ravagers that used to work with him a long time ago. You don't even have to know that those characters are the original Guardians of the Galaxy from the comics. And anything else about him, I think if you just came into it completely blind about this, it's cool that James Gunn went to the source material and said, you know, I know I put Yondu in this movie, but wouldn't it be cool if we gave him this whole life before that we didn't say anything about and that you didn't know about before now? And we gave him this other family that he used to have, you know, and they're sort of, he's fallen out with them, but he redeems himself with this action. I think that was a really cool idea. And that's a great example of somebody taking source material and using it to sort of inspire them to do something completely different than what the actual source material was about. I think that was really cool. I think the post-credit sequence probably has the biggest Marvel cosmic reveal possible. I don't think you can do anything more. Like, if you're, for the people who are fans of that type of comic book, this was like the ultimate big aha thing you could put in a post-credit sequence, and I'm very excited about it. I definitely nerded out. I don't know if the average fan is going to care about it, but
nope.
I think it was cool, and I think it's a sign that as he goes further into this franchise, he's going to more and more fully embrace the sort of just complete wackiness, pseudo-spirituality stuff of that cosmic storytelling. But it all works if you ground it in characters that we've bought into already.
Absolutely. And, yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, like, whenever – I'm not sure what the civilization is called, the all-gold people that you know,
the Aisha people, yeah.
Aisha, yeah. You know, I felt that – I thought that was just going to be kind of like a throwaway thing at the beginning. And, you know, by the end of the credits, they've woven it into the origin of a major – character in Marvel Cosmic, and that's incredible. That's like, yeah, I don't know. That's such a Joss Whedon approach in a similar way, where the teaser, I mean, in you know, not directly, but in the teaser for I think maybe Thor: The Dark World, or maybe. Captain America, I can't remember. There's, you know, it shows the Hydra guy, and it's Baron von Strucker, and he says, like, this is the Age of Miracles, and, you know, it's the gem that gives them the powers that ends up creating Vision. You know, it's like, it's one of
right.
those things where it's like, this feels like a throwaway thing just to kind of, you know, show this thing on off the page, and then it ends up being this major, you know, story progression later on. That's really cool. And yeah, I mean, that when she said the word ad, I mean, I wasn't putting it together when I saw the chamber, but then she said
I wasn't
Adam,
either.
And,
yeah.
And yeah, I let out an audible reaction and my wife rolled her eyes.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, it was awesome. And yeah, that's the thing is like James Gunn as the, and you can just, I mean, who knows? Maybe this movie's going to be terrible. Who knows? But you can just, it seems to be, based on the Ragnarok trailer, that James Gunn has set the house style for Marvel Cosmic, the same way that Favreau and Louis Leterrier set kind of the style for the individual movies, and then Whedon kind of set the tone for the team movies. So, like, James Gunn, like, set that house style, and I think the only problem that I really have with those other two Thor movies now, it's like, oh, well, all you had to do is just wait until after James Gunn told you how to make those movies, you know, and then we would have had a really good approach, you know,
if Thor had been treated as a cosmic story all along, I think that franchise would be more highly regarded for sure. But that said, I mean, to me, it also says a lot that the fact that James Gunn is doing as well as he's doing and getting all of this sort of influence, it seems, at Marvel. You know, one of the big questions that keeps getting brought up, whether it's by critics or Steven Spielberg or other directors, is people keep wanting to predict the demise of the comic book movie. And they're saying, people are going to get tired of this. It's all going to go away. We're going to get, you know, we're going to run out of original things to do with it. And I think it looks like Marvel is moving in understands that there are other directions they can go. It doesn't have to be earthbound billionaire gets sudden superpowers and becomes a superhero with it. It doesn't have to be a retelling of Batman or Superman every single time. You can do weird things with these stories. There's so much other stuff to go to, you know, and I'm not even sure Spider-Man is necessarily the best example of this, but the cosmic direction is certainly a different way to go with these things. Like, to make it more fully embracing the sci-fi thing, even getting into sort of weird, trippy, you know, kind of metaphysical stuff. That's
yeah.
a territory we haven't gone to yet with these movies in a fully embraced way. I think the fact that you look at the other movies coming up soon, you know, one of the upcoming Marvel releases they're working on is basically a story about African geopolitics and you know, I mean, that's definitely a different place to go with this. So there's lots of original genre territory to be mined and still stay on the basic plot universe that we've built here. It doesn't have to be origin stories and team ups every single time. There's different ways to go with this, and I think James Gunn has been a big part of, I think, informing the top brass at Disney and Marvel to understand that that's okay. This doesn't have to be, you know, either a guy with superpowers crash lands in a small town or a guy with a ton of money gives himself superpowers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like he's wanting to bend it. And, yeah, and I mean, it does seem like he and the Russos are kind of the story guys now. You know, they're the top guys. So yeah, I'm curious to see. You know, it seems like the first movie is always what it takes to see if a director is going to stick around and how much influence he's going to have. So now that Peyton Reed is kind of in the mix, you know, I'm wondering how different his next Ant-Man movie is going to be than the first one, because the first one was, you know, a very good example of this, but very much a, you know, superhero origin story, or Scott Erickson with Doctor Strange. So it's an encouraging trajectory, and yeah. I mean, is there anything else that you want to cover before we wrap it up?
No, I mean, I thought there were, in general, what I walk away from this movie with is I felt great about the time I got to spend with all these characters. I think they gave me reason to want to see more of them. The humor really is, I think, what I walk away from more than anything in this movie. And, you know, at some point we should get Ben Flanagan's take on the soundtrack, because I know he was very
yeah. So the only thing I
about
can say,
the choices.
I think he had an issue with ELO's Mr. Blue Sky being used for the opening because he feels like that belongs to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Was it even in that movie? Besides, it was in the trailer. I remember.
Yeah, it was definitely in the trailer. Yeah, I can't remember if it was in the movie or not. Which
I think. Let me say this: that the big music cue that everybody will walk away from this movie with is a Cat Stevens song from that's basically the last song in the movie before the credits. And mm-hmm. I'm as a Cat Stevens fan, I thought it was really well chosen. It's a very, you know, people could come out here and say, Cat Stevens blogs, Harold and Maude, get out of here, James Gunn. But then I think that gives it the sort of 70s feel that this movie attempts to recreate with its soundtrack. But it hits that sincerity so perfectly to me. And Cat Stevens is such a great choice there because the songs always feel sort of simultaneously sad and cheerful. And that was an excellent choice to me. I think that last scene of the movie, you don't want to leave people feeling down. You don't want it to be a downer of a scene, even though it's a funeral. You want there to be kind of a smile that you get with it. And I just think the musical accompaniment was perfect on that. So that's the soundtrack moment that stood out the most to me, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean it's a movie that it takes one or two other things that have been used before, or unoriginal things, and then it combines them all together and makes original things. You know, that's how a Tarantino movie works. That's how almost every movie really works. But you know, I mean, Ode to Joy can be used in different contexts than Die Hard. So that's kind of how I look at it. So that did not bother me at all. And yeah, I mean it's.
What song was playing during the big arrow scene? The Yondu arrow escape.
I was going to say
I don't remember the song, but
the song that I was whistling walking out, which is also the song that I think all of us whistle most of the time in life because it's just kind of stuck in all of our heads forever, is the Chain by Fleetwood Mac. You know,
yeah,
I feel like
that was
but it was
an
awesome
well
moment.
Chosen moment, yeah, and really, you know, I don't know that it hit me the first time, but I think the Star-Lord Rocket dynamic is really well done in this movie too. It sort of takes a back seat to some of the other character dynamics in the movie, but I think they give Rocket most of his important scenes based on that in his relationship to Peter.
Well, he's I mean, now he's in a way, he's a stand-in for Yondu. You know, he's the closest thing to Yondu that Peter has now. And there's that line at the end of the movie where Rocket kind of, you know, draws the parallels and says,
yeah,
you know, he was just a guy that stole some batteries, you know, as if to say that Peter was, you know, just ego was just using Peter as a battery. And it's like, wow, that's like, you only write that if you are so deep into your own screenplay that you're seeing connections that most people won't see ever, you know? And
yeah,
obviously you don't really want to call that out, like, every line, because then you're going to confuse everybody. But just to give one of your characters that kind of insight into himself and into the context around him does an awful lot. And, like, the look on Chris Pratt's face after Rocket says that is exactly the look that I had, where I was like, oh, wow, that parallel is really striking and really poignant and says so much about Rocket. And I don't know, it's so complex, and it's really satisfying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I said it on Twitter earlier, but it's like, I guess I can find issues with both of these movies, but if anybody said that they are tied as their favorite movie of all time, I wouldn't flinch at all. Because there is a effusiveness and a charm and a fun to Guardians of the Galaxy that it's very rare. And, I mean, I can't say that they're my favorite movies of all time, or even my favorite Marvel movies. Someday they might be. But it's just like these movies are so much fun, so great, and so constructive, you know. And they're not mindless fun, and that's a really difficult thing to pull off. And I think we should be appreciative of it.
Absolutely, I feel really good about it. I think it will be interesting when I kind of have come down from the post movie hive of how I feel about it and where it ranks, but I definitely think it lived up to the very high bar set by the first movie. And I'm excited about more of these characters. I'm excited about them having another movie of their own, but I'm also excited to see them get this weird interplay that they're going to get with the Avengers in about a year. Little bit more than a year. So that's cool to me. I walked out of, I know some people get annoyed how many of these movies there are, but I definitely, nope, a few minutes after this movie, I got to my car and said, man, I'm going to get another one with these guys in it in like a year. That's so cool. I love that. And, you know, I think it'll be a fun thing to watch, you know, play out. And I think that they've added to this weird experiment of the MCU, they've given us even more reason to actually care and be excited about this movie when it comes out, despite really have had no scenes with Thanos. But now I know why several of these characters hate him, and I want to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about looking forward. I mean, I think that's one of the most special things about these movies is that it always makes me look back. You know, and, like, there's this great thing about these freaking stupid Marvel movies where I see it, I have a reaction to it, and then either it goes away or I watch other movies or, you know, stuff happens, and then, like, either 6 months or a year down the road, I start thinking about it again, and I watch it again, and it's like I'm watching it with fresh eyes. And so, like, whenever I do my idiotic rankings and all that crap, like, it's never the same, you know. I'm always, and you know, sometimes the movies don't hold up as well, you know. I recently watched Iron Man 3, and it's like, okay, that's about the same, or maybe a little worse in some ways, a little bit better in other ways. But then I watch Age of Ultron again, and it's like, wow, that movie gets better every time I watch it. So, like, that's the exciting part of a Marvel movie, is that that it's not disposable entertainment that you just throw away. It's a movie that you watch, and then you know that, okay, my relationship with this is going to change over time. So it's not just about how I react when the credits end on opening night. And that's a fun and exciting thing.
Yeah, it's fun. The experiment is still working for me so far. Maybe one day it'll all come crashing down, and I'll be pissed about it all. But for now, this is a cool and unique thing and nobody else has ever done anything like this before, and it's working out well so far, in my opinion.
Yep. What are they, 12-0?
I think this was maybe the 15th.
15-0, okay. Well, there you go.
That's national championship numbers right there.
Matt, I don't know what you just said.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.